verse 19 through to 34. These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife, because she was barren. And the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak, so they called his name Esau. Afterwards, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore his name was called Edom. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." And Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is my birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Now, it's an interesting episode as far as Genesis is concerned. This week, as I was preparing for this message, I was just thinking about how stupid decisions are often made when we're in a rush and when we hurry. When we rush and hurry to be somewhere, we let speed limits slide and we end up with tickets. When we rush and hurry for our home renovations, we bury ourselves in unmanageable expenses and debt. When we rush and hurry to get into our much-anticipated relaxation for the evening, we inflict all kinds of relational damage on people who get in our way, right? "I want to watch my TV episode. Don't get in my way. I'll growl at you." We do this, right, when we rush and hurry for something. And it got me thinking, why? Why is it so? Why do we do this? Why do we think that hurry and rush is so important that we're willing to make stupid decisions because of it? As I turned this over in my mind, it got me thinking that in our culture, hurry and rush are celebrated as virtues. We are told that this is actually wise, to live a life of hurry and rush. And here's what I mean. You and I are regularly told that the best life that we could ever hope to live is to live in the here and now. To live in the moment. We are routinely told that this is a wise way to do life. And this usually translates to the gratification and indulgence of all our immediate impulses and desires. Whatever it is that you want to experience right now is what you should in fact chase after. Don't let anything get in your way. Chase that immediate impulse and desire. Get into that chat room. Pick up that phone. Sever that difficult relationship. Rack up some debt. Dissolve your difficult marriage. Whatever it is that you want to do, you are told to do it right now, to live in the moment. And you can deal with the consequences later. If ever. Right? This is a virtuous thing in our culture to do. To do whatever it is that we need to do to live in the moment. And consequences be damned. In the Bible, we find a very different kind of wisdom. For those who have ears to hear the wisdom of the Scriptures, we find a very different kind of wisdom. It calls out hurry and rush as a foolish way to do life. The Bible says that is foolish. Don't buy into the cultural virtue of hurry and rush. And I'll give you a couple examples from what is known as the wisdom literature of the Bible, and hence where we find sayings of wisdom. All of these quotations come from Proverbs, and then we're just paying attention to how hurry and rush is being told is foolish. It's an unwise way to do life. Whoever makes haste with his feet misses his way. The plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty. Do you see a man who is hasty in his words? There is more hope for a fool than for him. So the wisdom literature just makes us aware that there are lots of ways in which we hurry and rush, whether it's with our words or our decision making, and lots of ways hurry and rush will only lead to foolish outcomes. Our passage this morning picks up on that same theme. It shows us, as we have read, that Esau's hurry and rush for the instant gratification of food were instruments of foolishness, where he disregarded the consequences of selling his very inheritance. As we dig into this passage then, I first want to have a look at a wise way of life that we encounter in the passage. Before it gets to the problems of hurry and rush, we are first told what the virtues of slowing down and living an unhurried way of life looks like. If you remember, Isaac married when he was 40 years old, right? And he's looking to start a family without success. So what is a man to do? What is a man to do? I suppose the wisdom, if there was hurry and rush wisdom in his age, in his day and age, it would say something like this. Isaac, you're trying to have a family. You're obviously not getting anywhere with Rebecca. Here's some hurry and rush advice for you. Take a concubine. Divorce Rebecca. Try another wife. Do something immediate to fix your problem. That's what the hurry and rush wisdom tells us, right? Fix now. Deal with the issue now. Live in the moment now. And maybe Isaac would have heard wisdom like that. And after all, many of his contemporaries did choose that way of life. They did choose concubines in order to proliferate the family line, didn't they? We find this in the Bible. But Isaac seems to have done something so different to the hurry and rush wisdom we frequently find. He resisted hurry and rush in order to pray. The activity of slowing down to seek the wisdom of God for his life. Verse 21 reads as follows, that Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. I think that's a profound statement on resisting hurry and rush. We often look for answers and solutions to our problems, and we hurry and rush in our efforts to solve our problems with every mean we can find but prayer. And Isaac seems to do the exact opposite. His response to a problem is not to go and find concubines and find instant solutions and instant gratifications. His most notable response to the barrenness of his wife is to pray for her. Doesn't that make you rethink some things about how to handle a life with all its frustrations and problems? That there is wisdom for God's people to slow down and to take up serious prayer and to throw yourself on God for his help. Of course, we are not unaware that many of our friends or neighbors or even ourselves have become distrustful of prayer. We no longer consider it wise or a useful task in the Christian life. And sometimes this happened because we've been told that prayer, if we have enough faith, right? If we're zealous enough, if we've read enough Bible and just prayed super awesome Bible prayers, it will bring instant fixes to our problems, right? If we can drum up enough internal energy, somehow that will make our prayer effective. And so we've tried, we've approached the Lord in genuine zeal, and we prayed fervently, and our problems are still there. A month from now, our problem is still there. 6 months from now, a year from now, 2, 3, 5, 10 years from now, our problem is still there. And so we begin to be hardened against the sincerity of Christians and the truthfulness with which they speak about prayer. If that's you, if you've been put off prayer because the answer didn't come as quickly as you had hoped, I just want to point out one small detail in the text that may be a help to you. It might help you. While God did respond favorably to Isaac, there was a child. Don't miss the time scale involved in God's answer to Isaac's prayer. See, Isaac's prayer, even though it says that he prayed to the Lord for his wife and that the Lord answered him, it is by no means an instant and a quick fix. Remember, Isaac married at the age of 40, and verse 26 tells us that he was 60 by the time he had his twins. That's 20 years of waiting on the Lord to answer a prayer. The Bible doesn't give you simplistic or naive, trite answers about prayer. It doesn't say that your problem will be fixed right away. Isaac had to wait 20 years resisting the temptation for hurry and rush to fix the problem by some other means, like his father Abraham had, right? By choosing a concubine instead of persisting with Sarah and seeking the Lord's answer for a child that way. He waited 20 years. Keep this in mind, won't you? Maybe it will help you rethink some of your distrust toward instant results in prayer. I'll leave that thought with you. We move on. If the first part of the story tells us how Isaac resisted hurry and rush for gratification over the course of 20 years, the second part of the story takes a dramatic turn in another direction. It begins by recounting a horrific pregnancy for Rebecca, right? Don't read this with sweetness in your eyes and rose-colored lenses, right? It was a terrible pregnancy. It was no poster child pregnancy for what you'd hold up to your women's ministry as the prime example of a beautiful and natural way to be pregnant and to birth a child. It's the kind of pregnancy that lemon water and frozen meals are not going to make any easier. According to the original Hebrew here, the twins were literally smashing each other in mum's womb. They were getting at it. That ain't a blissful, peaceful pregnancy. That's horrible. Ask someone who's been pregnant what that would be like, man. To have two children going full on UFC in your stomach for your pregnancy. Joyful and blissful it was not. And Rebecca knew this, right? This ain't a pleasant experience. And so she goes to the Lord in prayer to seek an answer. Our English Bibles makes this prayer sound a little awkward. Follow with me. If it is thus, why is it happening to me? Hebrew scholars tell us that this translation is just a little soft. It tries to smooth out too much of the feeling behind all of this. They tell us that a more literal rendering would convey more a sense of distress. Something like, "Why God? Why me?" Sometimes life being what it is drives us to these kinds of prayers, doesn't it? Sometimes we just burst out these prayers of distress. Why God? Why me? I want you to note that this is a very different kind of prayer from a belligerent person who feels privilege and outrage when their Wi-Fi signal drops for a moment or two. You know, when people just shake their fists because they don't get the internet for half a day and they're like, "Why God, why me?" It's not that kind of prayer that Rebecca is praying. She has got sincere faith, seeking an answer from the Lord about this distressing situation that she's in. Right? We find these prayers in the Psalms a lot of the time. It's just distress. Why God? Why this distress? It's that kind of prayer that the Lord kindly answered for Rebecca. He kindly does give her an answer, doesn't resist her motives. And Rebecca is told that these two sons of hers, the reason why there's this battle internally, physically, internally, right, is because it signals a future divisiveness and fracture and rivalry between them. Both her sons will be very important historical figures as far as world history is concerned. And in the coming weeks, we'll hear more about the significance of this rivalry. But for our current purposes, firstly, we just want to note that God answered her prayer, right? God doesn't go silent and goes, deal with it. He does answer, even though it may not be a relief to her to hear it. It does give her some sense of understanding of what's going on. But then also for our purposes, we need to understand the significance of being a firstborn in the family. Because even though there are twins, it matters who comes out first. And in ancient culture, that matters very, very, very much. It's a crucial element to the story. And what's so crucial and important about being the firstborn, you may ask? Historians give us this helpful summary, a way of understanding why is the firstborn such an important concept in the ancient world. They tell us it has to do with the law of primogeniture, which is the right of the eldest child, especially the eldest son, to inherit the entire estate of one or both parents. It included a number of other privileges and responsibilities. The firstborn son also inherited the leadership and priesthood of the family or tribe, and he received a double portion of the inheritance. We find some resemblance, don't we, in the concept of komatua, that there is wisdom that is entrusted to the eldest. So whatever twin would be born first, whether it was Esau or Jacob, they would be handed this privileged position of honor within the family, a responsibility that was worth treasuring and worth respecting. And so you skip a few years and you find Esau and Jacob going about a day's activity according to their gifts, talents, and dispositions of character. This passage tells us nothing about what it means to be a manly man. Don't get from this passage that somehow to be a manly man you have to be a hunter, and to be an effeminate man means to be dwelling in tents at home and being a mama's boy. That's not what this passage is trying to communicate, right? You want to go and be like Esau? Go get naked and go and bite a deer to death somewhere in the woods and tell us all about it. This is not what the passage is telling us about manliness. Okay? We pick it up in verse 29. Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I'm exhausted." Once again, we are told that this English is a little bit soft. Just the rendering doesn't quite capture the outburst and the impulsive nature of Esau here. One guy, Derek Kidner, a well-respected Old Testament scholar, he offers this translation. He says that Esau, more likely that it should be rendered something like, "Let me gulp some of this red stuff that you have made. Let me gulp it down right now. I need it." And so this impulsiveness returns to us as the theme of hurry and rush in the passage. Esau sought after this instant gratification way of life. It also provides the real tragedy in the story, this impulsive nature of Esau, that he was so driven by immediate satisfaction, right? To have his immediate itch scratched, to live in the moment, that he cared so little for the consequences. So little that he traded away that privilege and honorable position, that birthright of being the firstborn child. See, he just wanted to live in the moment. And strangely, culture tells us that this is a wise way to live. Live in the moment. Don't think about consequences. Just enjoy the moment, right? If it feels good, you should probably do it right now. That's wisdom in our culture. And this Bible passage gives us a warning of sorts against that way of life. As I said earlier, the Bible warns us that this is a foolish approach to life, to gratify all our cravings immediately. Not least of which is because when we're under the influence of these strong impulses and desires that beg us to be gratified, right? These strong desires that we have looking for gratification. When we're under the influence of such an impulse, we become blind to consequences that we'll have to deal with later. Isn't that true? Isn't that true that you feel a strong impulse or a desire that may be quite sinful and you become quite blind to what your actions will mean for the future? That is what sin does. It blinds us. And sometimes these consequences that we actually need to be aware of are immeasurably serious consequences. They're not slight consequences, they are immeasurably serious. You might say, just hold up just one moment. How did we get from Esau selling his birthright to our actions having immeasurably serious consequences? What kind of leap are you making out of the text like that for? If that's your question, I'm glad you asked. The New Testament builds this link for us. It tells us exactly how we make that leap from Esau to considering the consequences of our actions. See, when the New Testament reflects on this episode of Esau, when the authors think back about what happened in Genesis, and they particularly pick up on Esau, and they reflect and they think about how Esau chased immediate gratification and then rejected long-term consequences. And then the New Testament recognizes that impulse to do that, to hurry and rush our way into instant gratifications, consequences be damned, that is true of all of us. We all feel that kind of pressure and temptation that Esau felt, or that desire that Esau felt to be gratified. There is a humanly relatable truth for us here. We find this in Hebrews chapter 12, if you want to cross-check with me. The author, of course, of Hebrews 12, he's in the middle of a section where he's at length encouraging Christian people not to give up on their salvation, right? Not to biff it all in the bin and say, stuff it, I don't want to be a Christian anymore. He's writing them by example after example after example of people of faith, men and women, who have hung on through good and difficult situations in life in order to obtain that salvation that we hope for as Christian people. And after these rich examples of people who have walked by faith and held on to this wonderful salvation in Jesus, the author shifts his thoughts and he gives warning. He gives warning to Christian people not to give up on that salvation, not to chuck it all away like Esau did his birthright in exchange for a small and momentary gratification. We pick Hebrews 12 up in verse 15 and 16, where we read this: see to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God. So that's like a picture or a description of salvation, to obtain the grace of God. And then he's going to go on now to give us three ways in which we fail to obtain that grace, how we fail to attain to salvation, how we chuck it all in and say, stuff it, I don't care about that salvation. He gives us these things. He says the roots, see to it that the root of bitterness doesn't spring up and causes trouble. Bitterness. Bitterness is a way in which we biff in and surrender our salvation's interesting. And then he says, see to it that no one is sexually immoral. So he's saying there is a temptation to be sexually immoral, and by that we fail to obtain the grace of God. And then he also gives us another example, or unholy, like Esau, right? Esau didn't give up his birthright through bitterness or sexual immorality. He gave it up through an unholy decision, who sold his birthright for a single meal. So when you read Genesis 25 with a mind to read it through the lens of the New Testament, Esau trading his birthright for a meal becomes a warning to the community of faith about doing the same, about trading your salvation for the instant gratification of an unholy life. Esau's example is a profoundly potent warning not to live your life that way, to not live in the moment, but to consider consequences, because some of these consequences are immeasurably serious consequences, like trading and giving away the grace of God that you seek to obtain. So let's put this into practice. One way that may keep us from trading away our salvation, one thing that keeps us in the grace of God, is to put some perspective to our decision making. To think of your decisions much like you would put two weights in a scale. To think, is this action that I'm about to take equivalent or of worth to the salvation that may be at stake? Does it balance, right? Does it make sense to do this and spend this, or to give this away, right? Ask yourself, is indulging, and we're just going to think now of what Paul thinks, says in Galatians here. He says, to ask ourselves, is indulging your desire for sexual immorality, for impurity, for sensuality, for idolatry, for sorcery, for enmity, for strife, for jealousy, for fits of anger, for rivalries, for dissensions, for divisions, for envy, for drunkenness, for orgies and things like these, are they worth trading your salvation for? Is it worth it? Is gratifying the momentary fit of anger worth salvation? Stop for a moment to weigh the trade-offs of your actions. May well be the means by which God saves you from frittering away your salvation. That said, I imagine if we're honest with ourselves, even as Christian people, we have often traded God away and out of our lives in favor of some immediate and unholy gratification. So in many ways, the warning that we receive from Esau functions much more like a fence at the top of the cliff. But many of us recognize that we are people who have busted through that fence, and we are now at the bottom of the cliff, and we are wondering if there's any help for us in our crumpled up state. If that's you, it may not be too late. See, that passage that we quoted from in Hebrews goes on to call Jesus the mediator of a new covenant. It tells us that Jesus is the person who facilitates a new way of relating to God. And part of this new way of relating to God is God's gift to his people to give them a new nature and a willing heart to heed the warnings of the Bible and to prize their salvation over and above the temptations for sinful instant gratifications. That is a promise of the new covenant, that you will become and be made more that kind of person. That you are not a victim of your desires which beg for instant gratification. You do receive a new nature upon becoming a Christian in the Spirit of God indwelling you. You are not a helpless victim to your desires anymore. You can, in fact, resist. And so God gives us that hope that there are, for those of us who have crashed through the fence at the top of the cliff, may yet again find the grace of God, returning to Christ and recognizing and prizing the salvation that he offers over and above those gratifications which press us day in and day out. And that salvation that he offers is nothing short of a completely redeemed life, free from sin and its power, in the presence of God for all eternity with unending joy as people living under the reign of their King Jesus. That salvation beats any dopamine feedback loop that sinful gratification might offer you in this life. That's my message for us this morning. We pay attention to Esau. Avoid the folly of rush and hurry when the consequences are so serious in the Christian life. Remind us again that there is gospel hope for all of us, those of us who have crashed through the fence and lie injured at the bottom, waiting on the Lord to see if he would still help. He will. He is there. The gospel remains true.